Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Cindy DeFerdinand, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Cindy DeFerdinand.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show today.
Okay, well, we have a special guest with us today that he and I have crossed paths in a good way through social media and actually had contact with I guess, Jamie, I had some contact there in the front with one of your promotion people or whatever. So appreciate you reaching out to the Concierge Coaches Show. And we're always excited to have a new coach come onto the show and showcase what they do. And you're out in the LA area, so known as the unconventional coach.
I love that, Jamie.
So, Jamie, go ahead.
You'll see why in a minute.
Jamie's also a psychotherapist as well as a coach. But yeah, we want to hear all about why you are called the unconventional coach.
And also about some of the techniques you employ and stuff like that. So go ahead and kind of introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, awesome. So thanks for having me, first of all. So, yeah, I'm Jamie Green. I am originally from England. I moved out to Los Angeles in 1983. I actually went to Pepperdine University, studied sports medicine. So my undergrad is in sports medicine. And then I'm just going to share a little bit of the story because it's a significant kind of life-changing experience. But so I basically did my undergrad in 3 years. It was a four-year degree I did in 3 years. And I'd been in boarding school since I was 11, so I wanted to get the hell out of school. And so I was essentially supposed to go back. I mean, I was technically supposed to go back to England. That extra year, I had a visa that allowed me to kind of stay in the country and work. But I was actually a drummer. I was an 80s pop drummer. So I was kind of working in studios and touring. And that was kind of like my actual life I was doing. But the story is, it's of significance. I was driving to an Elton John concert at Universal Amphitheater. I was house sitting for an actor at the Palisades, Pacific Palisades. I was driving up Sunset with a buddy. We pulled into kind of an iconic place at the time in the 80s called Chin Chin on Sunset, which, Cindy, you might know. And yeah. And I basically, it's a very long-sorted story, which I'll keep brief, but I fell in love with the hostess.
And we love stories. We love stories. Yeah. Fell in love with the hostess at Chin Chin's.
Fell in love with the hostess at Chin Chin. She was like my boarding school dream, you know, 5'10", all-American girl, and moved in with her within about a week. And the short end of the long-sorted story was, it turned out she kind of mentioned that she'd been in rehab for cocaine, just kind of casually mentioned it. But I was really a very, very naive kind of a pop star. I'd never done any drugs. The boarding school I went to, you'd be expelled for smoking a cigarette. So that was not my background. She never did anything around me. But gradually, over the course of a few months, she started to kind of disappear. And it turned out she was, mm-hmm. wasn't just coke, by the way. She was pre-based in cocaine, which is like the precursor to crack in the 80s. So and this is like 1986, turning, you know, like around the New Year's into 87. And so long story short, she relapsed, she went into rehab. And while she was in rehab, I had this kind of rude awakening about what the hell is this whole, what is this world of addiction and recovery? It was just a complete confusing mess for me. And I was introduced to codependency, which was all the rage in 87. Codependent No More just came out. And it was literally a life changer because I had the rug pulled out. And it was such a, and I was a very naive 21-year-old at that time, by the way. But it just was such a powerful upheaval for me that the academic in me wanted to really understand this. And so the normal Al-Anon 12-step approach was not registering. I needed to study the neurochemistry. That's really how, because, well, it's sports medicine. I love that stuff. So I literally went on to UCLA Extension and I became a certified alcohol drug counselor, really under the guise of buying time in terms of student visas so I could stay in the country and really wanting to understand what is this world that doesn't make any sense to me. And so that, you know, naturally evolved into me going on and doing my master's in marriage, family, child therapy. I got licensed in 1990, and very reluctantly, ambivalently, to be fair, became a therapist. It was all about buying time and trying to figure out my relationship and staying in the country. So at the time, in order to get my green card as a drummer, you'd have to be Phil Collins, basically. You'd have to be a massive pop star. You know, drummers don't get green cards, but therapists can. So I did all of that. And I'm saying this because I never aspired to being a therapist. It was not a dream to be a therapist. I was very ambivalent about it for a long time. And that's an important part of the story, because my ambivalence, even though I was really good at it, I turned out to be very good because I care about people and I'm pretty insightful, but I really backdoored my way into it and didn't love it. And then combination of things along the way, 1996, I was introduced to a very powerful Men's Weekend experience and then got involved now for the last 21, maybe 22 years in men's work and leadership. And so I kind of grew, found my place among the men, if you like, and I became a leadership trainer and facilitator and had a lot of experience leading a region of 600 men in that world over time, kind of grew up in that world. And that for sure breathed new life into my practice, for sure. You know, the conventional therapy approach was just so tedious and boring to me. It was like trying to make theories fit that I just didn't relate to. So that's why I was ambivalent about it. Love people, didn't love the theories I was trying to stick them into the boxes.
It just didn't fit for you.
And I was never passionate about it. So the passion came from all of my volunteer stuff. It was the leadership stuff. Then I was introduced to Kabbalah. I ended up being a Kabbalah teacher for 8-9 years. That was a passion that kind of teaching exploded. So the unconventional part of my coaching is because I wear so many hats. So I closed my practice in 2004. I was teaching for 3 years from 2001 to 2004 while I had my practice. I was teaching at the Kabbalah Center in Los Angeles. And then in 2004, closed my practice to teach full-time. Spent 5 years traveling, teaching, leading events, thousands of people all over the world. And then this is now coming up to about 8 years ago, left that whole world and started my coaching practice. So what happened in, I think it was March, April 2009, I knew I didn't want to go back to private practice. So I was pretty clear that that was not working for me. One of the opportunities I had as a Kabbalah teacher, in addition to teaching lots of courses at night, during the day I used to go meet with students in their homes. I used to kind of go counsel them with some of the stuff, spiritual crisis they were going through, existential dilemmas, God knows what, helping them find their way to connect deeper. And house calls was kind of a rad thing. You know, you don't get to do that as a therapist, as you know.
Right, that's absolutely true.
But the experience of doing that was really refreshing, because you get to see people on their own turf. You get to really feel their energy. You get to see how they live. And so I just had this idea of, you know, I don't need to go back into sitting in an office. I re-up my license. I'm still a licensed marriage family therapist, but I work as a coach. So the transition happened then. And I used to describe when I started that transition from therapist to coach, which a lot of people now are trying to do, but then it was kind of like people weren't doing it.
And
it was peak recession. You got a picture. This is March, April 2009. They were like, the bottom fell out of the world, right? So I was starting a new career when everyone else was like running for the hills. But the model worked, because the format I worked with, you know, I remember doing a radio interview show much like this about 6 months into my coaching business, because people knew me as a Kabbalah teacher, they knew me as a therapist, they didn't know me as a coach. And they were asking a great question. They asked me, what do you see as the presenting issues that people have today versus maybe 5 years ago? A great question.
And it stumped me.
And I had to really think about it. And what I realized was, because of the nature of what was happening with the recession and the bottom falling out of every industry, I realized that what I was dealing with was helping people reinvent themselves, because that's what I've done so many times. And so I helped people go from being a gun for hire, where there was just no one hiring anyone, to creating their own business by thinking more consultant-like and being creative. And so, you know, on the one hand, when you've worked a lot, you have a lot of life wisdom. You just not, you know, you get to consulting is just about having a lot of great experience and wisdom. And then it's just a question of being a bit entrepreneurial and having a vision and being inspiring. So a lot of it was that, because I'd walked through it. And so my company that I began was called Off the Couch Consulting because it was like getting off the therapy couch. It was, you know, I always trained very psychoanalytically. I used to see people on the, you know, they'd be on the couch twice a week. I'd be sitting behind them. And it was like, enough with the therapy. We're going to get into in the trenches, short-term, strategic, get people in and out. Maybe it's 3 sessions, maybe it's 3 months, but it's certainly not years of therapy. And so that model has really catapulted me in the last 8 years because people love that format. I have a constant revolving door of people coming in and bringing people to me and getting out, and I get in and get out. And so as
get in and get out, I love it. I love it.
Really, it's a little bit of hit and run, but it's give people tools and let them get on with it. It's not what you do as a therapist. As a therapist, you listen. I believe that people were getting obsessed with recovery too. I mean, the thing that the therapy model, and I don't mean to step on anyone's toes who's still doing this or therapists. I'm speaking as my own experience of 20 years as a therapist before I became a coach. And that is, I've noticed that so many people were just truly almost addicted to their process of working through something and recovering, whether it's recovering from child abuse or recovering from a bad marriage or, a divorce when they were a kid or embezzlement.
Yeah, yeah.
And they spent years and years and years processing and processing and processing. And I would say, look, it's enough with the stories. I don't need 17 examples. I need one. I get it. So what I say to people now is that it's a technique, but it's an approach, which is I have x-ray vision. I just see through the layers. I've been doing this too long. It's 30 years. I don't need lots of story. I feel people. I work with a lot of people on the phone. I never get to meet them. I can feel stuff really quickly. I think it's just wisdom, experience, trial and error,
intuition.
Whatever it is.
But probably intuition.
It's all of that. You,
laced
just,
in,
you get it.
Yeah.
For sure. So, at this point, it's really just a matter of getting them out of the story, getting them out of the loops, getting them out of the patterns. That's really what it comes down to. And and I love it. As you can tell, I'm very passionate about this. And I hate
I can feel it. I love your story. I love the passion. I feel like what you're trying to say is like getting them out of staying stuck in whatever they're stuck in, whether it's the story, the trauma. It's like getting people up and moving, and that's such a big part of what coaching is. You know, it's so, and all your experience in the past, of course, like what you said, leads you to helping people. You know, the older, the wiser, the professional, the personal experience, and the fit of therapy not really being a fit seems to have led you to coaching. And when you said that you do a lot of creating their own business coaching, is that your primary focus in your coaching business?
Is my primary focus is what?
Create, you know, helping people reinvent themselves and create their own business.
No, not necessarily. That just was what happened to be happening at that time because of what was going on. At this point, I get, because I'm a clinician and people know that, I'm more than just a coach because I deal with pathology too. I deal with anxiety disorders in a way that maybe your average coach is not equipped to deal with or wouldn't tout themselves as doing that. I get everything sent to me. I think reinvention comes along. I do a lot of couples work. I mean, a lot. You know, so I just do a lot of different things. I think that there's nothing new under the sun. You know, everything starts to look very similar after a while. It's just a question of what I'm committed to is getting people tools. That's not what we do as therapists, I think. We create a container. We listen. We do a beautiful job of creating a space for people to feel safe to then obsessively recover and process for years, which I don't know is the model that works. For me, what I think works is do a little bit of containment. You don't need a lot of storytelling. We need a little bit, and then we empower them. We give them the tools. We get them the hell out of their way, break some pattern, break some loops, and move them on. That's really what I'm committed to now. And
that
I
sounds like coaching.
I don't mean to be blasé about it, but I say that because I think that's what it's about now.
Yeah, it's
everyone's paid their dues. They've all done years of therapy. Yeah.
Yeah, it's time to move on, right? Coaching helps you move on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Jamie, I noticed the man, this what's the name of the band? Night Horse? Is that the
which that band? The band?
Night Horse?
No, which band are you talking about?
Is that the band you were a drummer for?
No, I was a drummer in the band called Go West. I played for the Pet Shop Boys in the '80s. Played with Thomas Dolby in the '80s. There are a few electronic.
I remember the Pet Shop Boys. Yeah, yeah.
And Go West. Huh? That was very nice. Very nice. How about that? That's awesome. Now, do you also do interventions of sorts or anything on that angle?
I mean, it's funny you say that. I literally was called to do one recently. I mean, I wouldn't say it's one of the things I do. It comes up, and I don't believe the standard intervention works terribly well. I think it's a lot of creating partnership. It's kind of a family systems approach. So I would say when it comes up, it's really, really important to create rapport and connection and trust and try to get as many people on board. But I have a very, very good friend who's one of the top interventionists in the country. And he works with a lot of pro athletes. So when it comes to the real deal, you know, he's the guy I would send in, not me. But it comes up in small ways, and not necessarily addiction and recovery issues. Sometimes it's intervention because someone's just... It came up recently, for example, where a father was involved in a Ponzi scheme. This literally came up about a month ago. The father, who's retired surgeon or something, got involved in a Ponzi scheme, and the kids, the grown kids, were really concerned about him, and they were flying out from Boston, I think, to come confront him in Hermosa Beach, and they contacted me, and, you know, and I tried to give them as many tools and set them up and tell, you know, try to empower them to take a different approach than just confronting someone, because this is a very smart man that's not likely to go, oh, yeah, you're right, I should stop doing this. It's just not really how it is. So that was interesting. It just happened, and I think they're still in the process of trying to deal with it. But yeah, I mean, I certainly deal with recovery issues all the time. It always comes up, and addiction issues. But I wouldn't say it's a specialty. It's an area I have lots of experience, but I don't focus on it, you know, only when it comes up. The truth is, most people acting out with addictions are not looking for that much help. So I tend to work with people who already have some sobriety under their belt, because that's why they're ready to tackle this stuff. The people who are still acting out aren't really looking for help yet. They haven't got there yet.
Yeah, but they're more willing to, you know, they're in the phase of building their life. I get that.
Yeah.
And the reason why I ask, because I see that you're in rehab reviews, and wow, that really indexed well for you on a Google search and whatever. It's a nice YouTube looking
video. I'm in a rehab review, really?
Yeah, yeah, under rehabreviews.com. So there's a thing on you there about Beyond the Couch with Jamie Green, and okay. Index was really well. So, yeah, good stuff.
Nice. Good.
So that was a surprise to you that you were indexed.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good.
I don't even know if I know what it means. Great. Cool. That means I'm official, and I'm not a charlatan. That's what that means.
Yeah.
It means
you're getting exposure. Okay, you don't even know. Just doing your thing, and it's happening.
Certainly looks fabulous.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Fabulous. Exactly. You have such a diverse background and interesting, you know, story. And I love how all of your experience cumulatively led you to this profession of coaching. And it seems like it really lit you up, that it was the mission you wanted. You know, kind of the course you want to be on, you know?
Yeah, and I wish I had come to this years ago. You know, it took a 9-year diversion through teaching Kabbalah. I didn't know it was even a possibility, you know, because it wasn't there. Now everybody's hip to it and everybody wants to do it because there's so much more freedom, right? But I think I would have done this a long time ago. It's just such a freeing way to work with people. It just feels more authentic.
It is. It's fabulous. I think it's a very good concept. Just what you said is, I wish I would have come upon it sooner. It's interesting, like, how life happens. You know, you build this cumulative professional and personal experience and story, and then somehow you're introduced to coaching. Somebody suggests, you know, like, it's just funny how life happens like that, and it's exactly where you needed to end up.
I'm just kind of curious how the Kabbalah experience got you to this part of your life now. What was it about that led to present day?
That's a good question. You know, what I've noticed in my life is what I've stumbled across has always ended up being the most powerful, purpose-driven, fulfilling work.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The stuff like I never studied to be a teacher. I never trained to be a credentialed teacher. I never trained officially to be a leadership trainer. I never trained to be a Kabbalah teacher. I never trained to be a coach, by the way. I don't have a coaching credential. I'm a licensed therapist. In many ways, I think my credentials supersede the coaching credential, you know, in some respects. So for me, what I'm saying is the doors just opened very organically in the areas where I think they're very mystical, spiritual doors that open, quite honestly. I think it's a calling when this thing happens. But when I when I stumbled across Kabbalah, really it happened because I had, when I was talking about the volunteer involvement as a leader in the men's organization I was doing, by the way, the organization is called MDI, which stands for Mentor, Discover, Inspire. So I was, I completed my leadership role and I started to have a life. I was probably putting 30 hours of volunteering in a week and loving it, by the way. But when I finally had some time, there was just an opening for me to go explore some personal growth. And so me and about 10 of my cronies that would follow me anywhere, we went off to the Kabbalah Center. And so I'd heard about it and some people had talked about it. I started taking classes and I kind of really loved it and got into it. It was fascinating. And then in my own way, started incorporating some of the practical aspects in my practice without referencing Kabbalah, without referencing anything, jargony, because it's kind of a thing I do well. I don't ram jargon down people's throats and sound like I'm in a cult. But essentially, I'm a bit, I'm kind of an enrollment machine, meaning that people will really follow me into anything I do. I probably enrolled 50 men into the men's work. I probably brought hundreds of people to the Kabbalah Center, quite honestly. So, and they could recognize that. So they just thought, this would be a great guy to have teaching and representing, who's more relatable than, like an Israeli teacher who barely speaks English. So so it just happened that, they said, why don't you give the free introductory lectures? And I started doing that and standing up there saying, look, I'm not a Kabbalist. I'm a teacher. I'm a student of Kabbalah, and I'm a shrink. This is just my love. This is what I love to do. And so that grew. And then I taught my first class, which was called Overcoming Fears, Phobias, and Anxiety, using the kind of Kabbalistic principles, mystical principles, along with my clinical experience, and 100 people would show up for the class, and it just started building from there. And so I started to just love, because bear in mind, I was working in a cave as a therapist. You don't see anyone, right? You're in a cave. I shared office space with 3 other therapists. You barely see them. You're just meeting people in and out of the waiting room. And it was a very isolated existence. And I'm a very social connecting kind of guy. And I didn't know that about myself, because I was living this very cut off Unabomber experience kind of thing. And, I'm going to use the term loosely. And so teaching, it got me out of my cave. It got me kind of into a place where I could really express my passion. I didn't know I had that. It hadn't really come out on that level. I just loved it. I loved being provocative. I loved being able to shake things up and be irreverent and all the things that I didn't get to do much as a therapist, because it was also freaking, locked down in many respects. And so that just opened up and blossomed, and I loved it, and I loved what it did in terms of empowering me to become creative and passionate in a way I never felt that in my office. And so, quite honestly, the transition was when I saw that there were some things going on directly in the Kabbalah Center that just didn't feel clean. There was a lot of integrity issues going on. I just knew it was time to leave that organization. And I just couldn't picture, after the 5-year kind of hiatus from therapy, going back into that world. So, as I said, it was really because I had the experience of loving just impacting people. I had no desire to go off and teach Kabbalah anymore or start a Kabbalah thing. And it was the house calls experience that I just put 2 and 2 together and thought, I remember going to see a business consultant, actually. And when I was kind of putting my ideas together what to do right before I finally completed the Kabbalah Center. And she said one thing to me that was so helpful. God love her. It really was. I literally saw, I think, 2 sessions, and I was just formulating some ideas. She said one thing to me that really stuck, and she said, look, there's probably many, many Kabbalah teachers out there. There's some wonderful therapists. There's some great coaches. There's some great teachers. But there's only one person who brings Jamie Green, and that's you. She said, literally Jamie Green.
I like that.
And I really heard that. And there was no ego in it. I really got, at that point, I know how I affect people. I know I got a lot of feedback over the years, and I started to take it in instead of deflecting it and owning it and knowing my value. And I think you have to know that at some point. And so I got on with it. So for the first year, I was Jamie Green Consulting, and then I incorporated and became Off the Cash Consultant. And I never looked back. And it's been 8 years, and I love every second of what I do. I just love it. I can't get enough.
That's fabulous. I could listen to you for another hour, actually. It's just an incredible story. And I love what your business consultant told you. There's only one person bringing Jamie Green. Yeah. And I love what you just said about knowing your value. Tell me a little bit more about what that means to you to, sort of know your value.
Yeah. Well, I think that, I think it's the Englishman in me, quite honestly. When we grow up English, especially boarding school, we grow up not wanting to stand out. It's the opposite of L.A., where everybody's trying to outdo how many likes and followers everybody's got, right?
Notice me.
It's the opposite. It's about being modest. It's about not being too big for your bridges. It's not boasting. And so for me, it was just a natural thing to kind of fly under the radar, which was easy when you're hiding in a therapy office, you know, when you're just hiding out. So I think what happened when I had more exposure in a teaching role where I had a community of hundreds of people and I had led events with 2,000-3,000 people at the time, I loved it. By the way, I didn't mention this. I've done reality television. I was on The Bachelor for 5 episodes as his life coach. And I was on a show on Fox called Marriage 911 that had 10 million viewers. And so, I loved TV because I wasn't scared of it. I appreciated it as a platform to actually be real and reach people in ways that maybe other people are not being authentic. And it's all a big show. It's all a big front. So I'm not intimidated by that because I know there's an opportunity to make an impact. And that really inspired me. So along the way of teaching many, many, many classes for many, many years and students coming up to me and letting me know firsthand how they were impacted by my style or my approach, one of the things I know about myself is that you can take some very, very complicated, heady, like 2,000-3,000-year-old wisdom of Kabbalah, which is very complicated and very heady and intellectual and existential, and I am able to distill it into very relatable language that everyone can understand, using modern anecdotes, using clinical anecdotes, but a way that people really get it. And I had that feedback over and over again. That's what they remember. They don't remember the complicated wisdom, but they remember how I brought it to them. That feedback has been consistent across the boards, whether it's the men's work, it's the Kabbalah work, it's that I'm able to express it in a way that people can understand it maybe for the first time.
Yeah,
so I capitalize on
it. That's a gift. It's a gift. Yeah, a gift that you're relatable, you know? Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Go ahead, Bruce.
I was going to say, very, very similar. I grew up a product of the 80s, and man, I remember doing the NLP training, learning from Janet Woiditz and Pia Melody and John Bradshaw and Father Leo Booth. Yep. And man, those guys, they just churn and burn even to this day with the Meadows and stuff like that. It's just the same thing rehashed over and over again. Then we have Patrick Carnes and sexual addiction and trying to get a shoehorn out and fit disease model into anything and everything.
Right.
So, man, I love that you and I are probably just right in the same age pocket there. I was a big fan of Go West, and people would say I was gay or something. I'm not gay, but I mean, I've got incredible heat for that here in Texas. I'll have you know. Anyway, but. Yeah. I know, right? But you can imagine.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, I think that's how interesting that is, and I won't get off on me, but it's a very similar situation where I didn't intend on becoming a coach nor being a co-host on this show. It just kind of happened. So I really like what you're saying, and it sounds like you are your brand. I mean, you're selling yourself and your ability to be the cue ball to get this get the game going here and busting in there and doing your thing. So that's a really fun thing because every day is a different day for you. So that's really cool.
I also can appreciate that not a lot is talked about ambivalence. I really get it. There's a couple of things that I talk about that I think a lot of people don't talk about. One is late blooming, and the other one is ambivalence. And I think that more people walk around ambivalent than they understand. They think they're depressed. They think they're shut down. They have language for it that's not really accurate. They're just not connected to what they're doing. They're either in an obligatory job, or they're in a job where they have golden handcuffs and they have to be in a job for the money, or they're in a relationship where they feel stuck because they want to keep together for the kids. A lot of it is ambivalence. It's not that people are depressed or shut down or anxious. They have not connected to their purpose. And it's a big thing for me because, as I said, all the things that I do that I'm passionate about has purpose behind it. And it was, ironically, I never made money at it. My time as a Kabbalah teacher was totally volunteer. My time leading the men was totally volunteer. It's now where it all came together. I get paid well for it, and I love it. and I get to do it, and I know it's a gift, and I know it's my high purpose, and I work with people who, in many ways, what they do for a living is not their joy.
Yes, I see that all the time.
Which I respect.
Right. And you don't, and we won't have to do that. And you hope they get there someday. You hope, you know, my hope is everybody gets to that passion and that purpose, and they get paid for doing something they love, or at least doing it part time while they're, you know, in the golden handcuffs or have the job or whatever, you know, that at least they, or volunteer like you did. You find a way to find joy and purpose and passion, and it ends up rolling up into this fabulous career path where you get paid for doing it. It's a great story. Is that what you mean by late blooming? Do you feel like you were a late bloomer?
Yes. So the late blooming thing for me, in many ways, well, I felt it on every level. I mean, you know, I didn't lose my virginity until I was 20. I didn't really have any major relationships till, you know, 21. That was the beginning of it, with that, you know, crazy experience that got crazier during my 20s with all my codependent stuff. And I had a kid at 49. I have an almost 3-year-old. So, got married first time at 37, which lasted 2 years, and then got married again at 42, I guess. Yeah, it's coming on 10 years. So everything I've come to, discovered my purpose and I purpose, you know, late into my life. And I think that there's something to be said about late blooming. I think it's actually, there's a lot of great stuff. Like having a kid at 49, it was the most seamless, effortless, easy thing ever. You know, and I have such a respect for 20-year-olds that have kids. I just can't even imagine how they deal with that. And I meet people all the time that have twins at 22. I mean, my hat goes off to them, because talk about, like, having to figure it out. But, I've been fathering for many, many years. So having a little boy was, like, amazing. Natural thing. It was like I've been doing it all the time. And even with career, you know, I'm sure you guys can relate to this, but the nice thing about aging is you don't sweat the small stuff. Who cares about insecurity?
Yeah, eventually you just don't give a shit. You don't have the energy for it, you know? You just, like, you know.
That's great. You walk around completely immune. You don't flinch. You let people judge and project all they want. You move on. Great.
But I love it. It is. It is fabulous.
I'm curious, Jamie, how – I think this ambivalence thing, you're really on to something here. And I think all coaches need to stop and listen to what's about ready to come out of your mouth. I mean, this is awesome when I ask this question. What are some of the techniques that you use to connect them or get your clients out of that ambivalence and then connected to something that they're more passionate about? Tell me about that.
I know. It's funny. When you mentioned the other day you wanted me to come with techniques, you know, it's funny. I have such an aversion to technique personally, because I am the least techniquey guy. I wouldn't say I have any techniques. Maybe I'm not meaning to not answer your question. I'm going to.
It may be semantics, but to me. What would Jamie do? Yeah, WWJD.
No, I get you. I would say the approach, always, my approach, my shtick, if you like, is really to help people cut through their bullshit and get to the truth. To me, that's what it's about. If you get to the truth, there's a truth about, I'm not happy in this job, and I have fear about not feeling qualified to do anything else. Then let's deal with that reality and find out if that's true or not, because I've created a story around it that may not be true.
Mm-hmm,
so the technique, the approach is cut through the stories that people have been, like, so shrouded in and conditioned by, and get past it. You know, it is scary to ask those questions. It's the art of asking really deeply provocative questions. It really is about questions. If you ask questions, I'm a big believer in discovery, realization and discovery, than filling someone with my wisdom, because I don't think that sticks. I've learned, I learned this teaching for 8-9 years, every week, hours and hours and hours, and I would have courses that would last 8-9 months. People come every week, and I'd start the class with a review, and they'd be like, huh? Like, they remember a freaking thing I said from the week before. What they remembered was the poignant kind of confrontational things that happened in the workshop. They remember the moments where we laughed and we cried and something to touch them. They don't remember the wisdom. So I know that people don't remember, they don't retain information. What they connect to is experience. And so to me, in my work with people, I get people to feel stuff, not just talk about stuff. That's what I meant by the processing of therapy. Not to say people don't feel in therapy, because they do. But there's a lot of just rehashing the same old freaking story over and over and using it as a way to box myself in. And you know, and it's just, to me, you're never going to get out of that. So how I get people out of it is I provoke them, challenge them. I nail them between the eyes with a lot of love. I mean, they have to trust me, so I don't do it until I know they trust where I'm coming from. But I was never this man. The Englishman in me would never confront, would never speak up. I was confrontation averse. That is clearly not who I am anymore, because the most liberating thing in the world to get past that, as you guys know.
It's
nothing
like called
better
freedom.
Than getting out
freedom.
Yeah, totally. And
totally
it's freedom
free.
For them.
Well, so yeah, because I was thinking about you. You said the fear, like people, you know, are stuck in their story and you have to get to the truth. And a lot of times there's fear there, why they're not moving forward, why they're staying stuck. So, you know, being able to get people to that, some people don't even realize it, you know, they're just living it.
Yeah, I think it's really about straight shooting. I think it's very refreshing. It was for me, as uncomfortable as it may have been, because it stings when someone nails you with the truth, if it's coming from love, but there's something incredibly refreshing about getting the truth, you know. And so I just, again, it's about the x-ray vision. I see it, so I call it as I see it. And a lot of people don't do that, because it's called risking the relationship. When you get real with someone and you risk bringing the truth, the risk is they'll shut down, they'll be offended, their ego will get engaged, they won't like what you had to say. But as long as they feel you care and the way you deliver it, that's kind of crucial. And I will teach you a term that I use, and it comes from a lot of the leadership work I do with the men, and it's called context, C-O-N-T-E-X-T. Context is a leadership term that we use to mean specifically the way I am being experienced, the way you're feeling me as I'm coming at you, right? It's the energy, my tone, my body language, it's my care. It's not the words necessarily, but it's how I'm delivering the message. And so people, even with couples, when I'm working with couples, which is a lot, 9 times out of 10, both of them are exactly right on. I mean, how can you not be an expert in your own relationship? When you're together 20 years, how can you be barking up the wrong tree? You know exactly what you're saying. The problem is the way it's being delivered, no one's going to freaking listen to that. And that's what I do with them. I'm like, who would take that in? You're a complete asshole. Why would I possibly respect anything you have to say if you're coming up that way? And that's just the truth. So what we do is we shift the context, which is not about sugarcoating and making nice. We just make it, we come from a place where there's care. If I don't feel you care about me, I'm not going to hear you. It's that simple. I don't care if you're right. And I know when you're right. We all know when someone's right, because it resonates.
We know the truth. We know the truth. Yeah. The truth is the truth.
So context is, it's probably the most concrete tool that I give people, and you can use it for everything. A context is what pulls people in and enrolls you, or it's what completely causes you to want to stay away from someone. It's a vibe, it's an energy. It's not something you manipulate at all. You can't bullshit a context. It's something that people are feeling even when you don't say a word. The example I give is you go to Whole Foods, you go to the market, and you're standing in line and there's 12 people in front of you. You get 12 different people's contacts in that moment. People are huffing and puffing, complaining, they're passive aggressive. Someone's just chatting and schmoozing and flirting with the person next to them. Someone's on the phone. Someone's irate, get the manager. And you just see not who they are, but how they're being in that moment. That's a context. That's total context. And so it's really important to know that the tool is not the context. The tool is shifting context when it's not serving me. That's
the tool. Kind of mindful.
We all have a context. It's not necessarily serving us, and it's not about who we are in the world. It's how I'm being in any moment, and that changes all the time. And sometimes it serves me, and sometimes it doesn't. So the tool is, what I say to people a lot of the time is, how's that working for you? And they know. They totally know. They just may not know there's an option to dip into their context toolkit and pull out another one. And that's what it's about, which you can't fake. You got to embody it. You have to. You can't. If you're not a compassionate person, you can't dip into the compassionate context toolkit. If you're not patient, you have to learn patience. You have to take a breath. You have to listen, not interrupt someone. You can't pretend to be, is my point. So this is not a surface technique. This is really about reaching in deep and having to get to some character, really get in there. And if someone doesn't have it, then you got to model it to them. I'm doing that a lot. I'm modeling to my couples what it looks like to be able to talk to someone in a way that they'll actually hear it, even themselves directly. And, you know, and get into it and scream as much as they scream if I need to and show them how ridiculous they're being. Now, who's going to hear that? You know, it's like not flinching, but it's intentional. It's not losing my cool and, like, getting reactive. It's doing it to show them how the hell would anyone listen to that?
All right.
So, you know, we really take risk. It's like I come out of my seat sometimes in ways that as a therapist I wouldn't do anything. I just shut up and be quiet behind the couch.
Exactly. Now you get to be you, right?
Yeah.
Fully you.
Yeah. Well, I get to be the unleashed version of me. That's true.
Yeah. The real. So there is this kind of mindfulness aspect with the like you're saying, it's the communication and the context and kind of in the moment, you know, that Johari window, how you're being seen by others in that particular context. So I think that's a nice way of describing and capturing those interactive styles. That's really nice.
Yeah. Cool. So I do have a technique after all, is what you're telling me.
There you go.
Oh, you have tools. You have tools, and you teach tools.
I got tools. I do.
That's the oral exam. Yeah. That's the oral exam here on LA Talk Radio. That's really good. And, you know, and coaching does give you the freedom to do that. You know, I have a licensed professional
counselor. Exactly.
And we don't really, you know, we're kind of bound and gagged by HIPAA and bound and gagged by other limitations. And it was so bizarre for me because as an executive coach, you know, the companies who are the stakeholders that were hiring me to coach, I say, hey, we need you to go to this event and we need you to interact with your clients in this event. I'm like, whoa, isn't that a violation of the confidential? You're like, no, if we're telling you to go to the event and interact with your coachees, you're going. Like, okay. Yeah. So you know what I mean? That paradigm shift was, that was a big one for me to swallow, but it's very differences.
Well, you know, the other thing about that, Bruce, is if, you know, not everyone is comfortable as a therapist, and maybe as a coach, and this may be true anyway, they may not be comfortable in revealing themselves and self-disclosing and using yourself in that way. And I've always been very, very comfortable. I shouldn't say never, because I'm sure I did at the beginning, you know, hide behind the mask, the veil of being the professional and the therapist. You know, one of the things that's been so liberating for me is not having to do that, is being able to get out from under the persona and be real. Because if I have this firm driving philosophy, if you like, that I will not ask anyone to do anything I'm not willing to do first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No client. I'm not going to ask them to reveal themselves, take the mask off, take a risk, confront, get in someone's face, shut the fuck up and listen. I'm not going to ask anyone to do that if I don't absolutely know that I can guide them in what it looks like. I stand behind that. And so revealing oneself without burdening the person, obviously, there's a fine line between breaking down and talking about your miserable marriage and giving an example of how you deal with conflict with your wife. There's a very big difference, right? So there's a way to bring some very true life examples that give people hope and how you navigate through it, as opposed to now making them really uncomfortable that you're taking their time on their expense to talk about your conflict.
Right.
That's a big, important distinction. I mean, I'm saying the obvious here, but you'll be amazed how many therapists do that. So to me, you have to be comfortable being your own instrument, and not a lot of people are. They don't know themselves well enough or trust themselves well enough to do that. And I think that, again, coming to the you know, we grow in conviction as we get older with wisdom and self-assuredness. That's when that becomes even more important, I think. You know, I don't know if I did it. Yes, exactly. I don't know at 25 I was as confident in doing it, nor did I have a lot of life experience to share at 25, as I do it, of course. But, yeah, that stuff's important.
You know, I wanted to say one thing in terms of you, Jamie, being the unconventional coach, because even like in revealing yourself and being comfortable using your own story, I mean, in the coaching modality, a lot of times they'll talk about, you know, you don't want to use the same story and you're always asking questions and you're never getting in somebody's face and you're never telling them what to do and you're not consulting. And, you know, I don't happen to believe that's true. I think, you know, you have to wear many hats when you are being of service to somebody. So in the way that you speak, in a traditional, you know, coaching model, I teach it. It's all about asking questions, and you're not the therapist and you're not the mentor and you're not disclosing yourself and you're not talking about. So you definitely are doing an unconventional pathway to successful coaching in your own unique way. And I really believe in coaching. We do bring the dynamic of who we are and how we serve, and there's no rules. There may be a few guidelines here, but there's, in my world, there's no rules as long as the client is getting a benefit and they're understanding why you're doing it, you know, what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Yeah, and I would, of course, and I would add that there is no cookie cutter approach. You know, there are some people that the level of trauma they have, the boundaries they're comfortable with, their own context that they tend to live in, they would not be comfortable with me being too irreverent and provocative and swearing and revealing too much. Where I need to be a little bit more conservative, dial it back. I mean, I can feel it. So I really match myself to who's in front of me. I don't go in guns blazing with everyone because that would scare the hell out of them. You know, I mean, that's come from trial and error and losing a lot of clients over the years, you know, for sure.
Right, right.
But it really is about tuning into and matching where the client is, well, back in the days where the patients were, and just feeling into, you know, what they would be comfortable with and taking my cues from them. And that's being able to really read people. You know, one of the workshops I teach is called The Art of Reading People. And it's one of my favorite things, and it's got nothing to do with NLP. I think all that stuff's bullshit, I'll be honest with you. Complete bullshit. I mean, I know people love that and swear by where your eyes are looking and how many blinks you're doing. I think it's all crap. For me, it's just feeling. It's really just feeling who's in front of you. And the only way you can do that, one of the things I teach in leadership is rule number one, you got to get the hell out of the way. And by that, I mean you can't be busy trying to look good and worrying about if they're getting your point and if they think you're funny and if they like you. That's being in the way. You can't hold a room that way. You read a room by completely being invisible to yourself and immersing yourself and feeling what's going on. And I got a lot of training running groups of hundreds to thousands of people. I could literally feel as an organism what needs to happen, when it's time to mix it up, when it's time to be irreverent, when it's time to create one of those needle-dropping moments where I say something so fucking real that the place goes silent because I've reached everybody. And mm-hmm. it's done with intentionality. Those moments, there are openings that call for those moments and openings that call for everyone to laugh, you know, hysterically out of comic relief. You know what I mean? And that comes from not a technique and not training and not public speaking and NLP and all that stuff that I know people teach, and I'm sure that they teach a version of it that's legit. But to me, it comes from naturally, organically feeling it.
Yes.
And I don't know you can teach that. I think all I can teach is you got to get out of the way.
Yeah, it's there or it isn't there.
Yeah.
And in the coaching world,
that's why I love...
Go ahead, Jamie.
No, I was going to say that's why I love teaching so much and leading a live event is because it's my biggest strength. My biggest strength is being able to take a giant mass of people and get them all aligned. I just know how to do it. In other words, one of the things we teach with context is the one with the biggest context in the room wins. And by biggest, it doesn't mean overpowering. It means how you can draw people to you. When I talk about being the Pied Piper with my enrollment, it's drawing people into my context. That means if I'm coming from a place where I'm in my heart and I'm really connected and grounded, I can get people there. Mm-hmm, doesn't matter if it's 100 or it's 1,000 or if it's a couple in front of me. I know how to do it. And you can't manipulate it. You have to embody it. This is one of the things that once people start learning this context thing, they try it like a shtick. Oh, now I'm going to be like the loving guy. And if you don't have love in your heart, you can't do it. I'm going to do the compassion context now. You can't bullshit people. They feel what they feel. And if you're going to reach them, you got to get them where they really feel it. You can't fake it. You know, I watch people all the time trying to bullshit it. And I mean, that's where politicians come in. I mean, it drives me up the freaking wall. Just watching these spokesmen, the people that are so fake, it just drives me crazy. I mean, I'm sure it's obvious to everyone, but it's just amazing to me to watch. Like, no one's teaching them context. They're just giving them the words.
Right, right. Well, it seems like you have that DNA chip, you know, that you just have that part of you, that processing chip that just, like you said, it's your biggest strength, that you have that innate ability. And it's free floating. It just happens for you, you know, so that's really cool that you have that strength. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show today. I want to thank
Jamie, what are some of the websites? How can you be reached through social media? What are your preferred websites so our listeners can find you?
So for me, they can find me at my website is jamiegreen.com. It's JAMIEGREENE. So jamiegreen.com is the easiest way to reach me, and you can get all my contact info there. I have a couple of products. One I'm really proud of is an app. Actually, you can get on the iTunes store or the Apple store, which is called Alchemy in Love. Alchemy in Love with Jamie Green, and it's kind of a cool relationship it's like a relate. It's like kicking the tires of your relationship and seeing where you're really at, both for men and women. And it's there's some content in there, what I call the four pillars of a man, which is for women. Make sure that the minimum requirement you need to make sure exists in your already husband or the man you're potentially dating as a suitor is make sure they really have these qualities, what I call the four pillars of a man. And for the women, you got to make sure you have the four layers of a woman. I get into all the kind of core tools of relationships. So there's that. And another product I'm really proud of is called my Off the Couch program. Actually, it's a 10-part audio intensive. It's a download, and it's 10 hours of what I call the 10 specific tools of how to be authentic, how to be real. And context is one of them. But just to give you an example of how to really, in a sense, is how to get your shit together and keep it together, and how to be more effective in the world. You know, it's stuff that I think a lot of people just don't talk about. I know what everybody talks about because I've heard it. We've all been there. We've been to all the Tony Robbins stuff. We've done all that stuff. Lifespring, Landmark. They all talk about the same thing. And I'm not suggesting I'm so unique, but I know that there's some angles that I talk about that a lot of people don't focus on. I think has been overlooked. So that's all of that's on my website. And then my on Facebook, there's the you can find me on Facebook. My Facebook page, et cetera, I'm everywhere.
Great.
And when you say preferred websites, you mean other things I've been inspired by or my own stuff? Is that what you meant?
That was good.
That was perfect.
So, yep, we got to shut her down. So, folks, welcome again. Yeah, it was a great show. Go to see Jamie and remember to see us. Go visit us on the latalkradio.com website. Our shows are archived. We're also on iTunes, Concierge Coaches Show. You'll be able to listen to this show and other shows. Every show we've ever done is on iTunes. Don't forget to see us on Facebook. I'm at Cameron Coaches on Twitter. And Cindy, what's your contact info?
714-943-6206. Please reach out if you have any questions. I'm available at my website, wisdomfoods.com. And thank you again, Jamie, for coming on the show today. It was fabulous to hear you and your story and all the help you're giving to people out there. So thanks again.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks, guys. This is really fun. Pleasure to support you. And let me know when you get the podcast. I would love to spread it and get the good word out with you guys, too.
Terrific. Thanks so much.
Take care. We'll see awesome. You all next time on the concert.
Over and out. Yep. Everybody have a great day.
Bye-bye. You too.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Cindy DeFerdinand, only on LA Talk Radio.